He hobbled into the village an hour later. It was getting dark. The villagers he passed said hello, but there was a sense of nervousness and of not quite knowing what was going on or what to do about it in the air. Old Thrashbark had been pulling on his beard a fair bit and looking at the moon, and that was not a good sign either. Arthur went into his hut. Random was sitting hunched quietly over the table.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm so sorry."
"That's all right," said Arthur, as gently as he knew how. "It's good to, well, to have a little chat. There's so much we have to learn and understand about each other, and life isn't, well, it isn't all just tea and sandwiches."
"I'm so sorry," she said again, sobbing.
Arthur went up to her and put his arm around her shoulder. She didn't resist or pull away. Then Arthur saw what it was she was so sorry about. In the pool of light thrown by a Lamuellan lantern lay Arthur's watch. Random had forced the back off it with the back edge of the butter-spreading knife, and all of the minute cogs and springs and levers were lying in a tiny cockeyed mess where she'd been fiddling with them.
"I just wanted to see how it worked," said Random, "how it all fitted together. I'm so sorry I can't get it back together. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I don't know what to do. I'll get it repaired, really, I'll get it repaired."
The following day, Thrashbarg came around and said all sorts of bob stuff. He tried to exert a calming influence by inviting Random to let her mind dwell on the ineffable mystery of the giant earwig, and Random said there was no giant earwig, and Thrashbarg went very cold and silent, and said she would be cast into the outer darkness. Random said good, she had been born there. And the next day, the parcel arrived. This was all getting a bit eventful. In fact, when the parcel arrived, delivered by a kind of robot drone that dropped out of the sky making droning robot noises, it brought with it a sense which gradually began to permeate through the whole village, that it was almost one event too many. It wasn't the robot drone's fault. All it required was Arthur Dent's signature or thumbprint or just a few scrapings of skin cells from the nape of his neck, and it would be on its way again. It hung around, waiting, not quite sure what all its resentment about. Meanwhile, Curb had caught another fish with a head at both ends, but on closer inspection it turned out that it was in fact two fish cut in half and sewn together rather badly. So not only had Kerp failed to rekindle any great interest in two-headed fish, he had also seriously cast doubt on the authenticity of the first one. Only the picker birds seemed to feel that everything was exactly normal. The robot drone got Arthur's signature and made its escape. Arthur bore the parcel back to his hut and sat and looked at it.
"Let's open it," said Random,
who was feeling much more cheerful this morning, now that everything around her had got thoroughly weird. But Arthur said no.
"Why not? It's not addressed to me."
"Yes, it is."
"No, it isn't. It's addressed to... well, it's addressed to Ford Prefect, in care of me."
"Ford Prefect? Isn't he the one who..."
"Yes," said Arthur tartly.
"I've heard about him."
"I expect you have."
"Well, let's open it anyway. What else are we going to do?"
"I don't know," said Arthur, who really wasn't sure.
He had taken his damaged knives over to the forge bright and early that morning, and Strinder had had a look at them and said that he would see what he could do. They had tried the usual business of waving the knives through the air, feeling for the point of balance and the point of flex and so on, but the joy was gone from it, and Arthur had a sad feeling that his sandwich-making days were probably numbered. He hung his head. The next appearance of the perfectly normal beast was imminent. But Arthur felt that the usual festivities of hunting and feasting were going to be rather muted and uncertain. Something had happened here on Lamuella, and Arthur had a horrible feeling that it was him.
"What do you think it is?" urged Random, turning the parcel over in her hands.
"I don't know," said Arthur. "Something bad and worrying, though."
"How do you know?"
Random protested.
"Because anything that's to do with Ford Prefect is bound to be worse and more worrying than something that isn't," said Arthur. "Believe me."
"You're upset about something, aren't you?" said Random. Arthur sighed.
"I'm just feeling a little jumpy and unsettled, I think," said Arthur.
"I'm sorry," said Random, and put the package down again. She could see that it would really upset him if she opened it. She would just have to do it when he wasn't looking.
Chapter 16. Arthur wasn't quite certain which he noticed as being missing first. When he noticed that the one wasn't there, his mind instantly leapt to the other, and he knew immediately that they were both gone, and that something insanely bad and difficult to deal with would happen as a result. Random was not there, and neither was the parcel. He had left it up on a shelf all day in plain view. It was an exercise in trust. He knew that one of the things he was supposed to do as a parent was to show trust in his child, to build a sense of trust and confidence into the bedrock of the relationship between them. He had had a nasty feeling that that might turn out to be an idiotic thing to do, but he did it anyway, and sure enough, it had turned out to be an idiotic thing to do. You live and learn. At any rate, you live. You also panic. Arthur ran out of the hut. It was the middle of the evening. The light was getting dim, and a storm was brewing. He could not see her anywhere, nor any sign of her. He asked. No one had seen her. He asked again. No one else had seen her. They were going home for the night. A little wind was whipping round the edge of the village, picking things up and tossing them around in a dangerously casual manner. He found old Thrashbarg and asked him. Thrashbarg looked at him stonily, and then pointed in the one direction that Arthur had dreaded, and had therefore instinctively known was the way she would have gone. So now he knew the worst. She had gone where she thought he would not follow her. He looked up at the sky, which was sullen, streaked, and livid, and reflected that it was the sort of sky that the four horsemen of the apocalypse wouldn't feel like a bunch of complete idiots riding out of. With a heavy sense of the utmost foreboding, he set off on the track that led to the forest in the next valley. The first heavy blobs of rain began to hit the ground as Arthur tried to drag himself to some sort of run. Random reached the crest of the hill and looked down into the next valley. It had been a longer and harder climb than she had anticipated. She was a little worried that doing the trip at night was not that great an idea, but her father had been mooching around near the hut all day, trying to pretend to either her or himself that he wasn't guarding the parcel. At last he'd had to go over to the forge to talk with Strinder about the knives, and Random had seized her opportunity and done a runner with the parcel. It was perfectly clear that she couldn't just open the thing there in the hut or even in the village. He might have come across her at any moment, which meant that she had to go where she wouldn't be followed. She could stop where she was now. She'd gone this way in the hope that he wouldn't follow her, and even if he did, he would never find her up in the wooded parts of the hill with the night drawing in and the rain starting. All the way up, the parcel had been jiggling under her arm. It was a satisfyingly hunky sort of thing, a box with a square top about the length of her forearm on each side and about the length of her hand deep, wrapped up in brown plasper, with an ingenious new form of self-knotting string. It didn't rattle as she shook it, but she sensed that its weight was concentrated excitingly at the centre. Having come so far, though, there was a certain satisfaction in not stopping here, but carrying on down into what seemed to be almost a forbidden area, where her father's ship had come down. She wasn't exactly certain what the word haunted meant, but it might be fun to find out. She would keep going and save the parcel up when she got there. It was getting darker, though. She hadn't used her tiny electric torch yet, because she didn't want to be visible from a distance. She would have to use it now, but it probably didn't matter now, since she would be on the other side of the hill which divided the valleys from each other. She turned her torch on. Almost at the same time, a fork of lightning ripped across the valley into which she was heading, and startled her considerably. As the darkness shuddered back around her and a clap of thunder rolled out across the land, she felt suddenly rather small and lost, with just a feeble pencil of light bobbing in her hand. Perhaps she would stop after all and open the parcel here, or maybe she should go back and come out again tomorrow. It was only a momentary hesitation, though. She knew there was no going back tonight, and sensed that there was no going back ever. She headed on down the side of the hill. The rain was beginning to pick up now. Where a short while ago it had been a few heavy blobs, it was settling in for a good pour now, hissing in the trees, and the ground was getting slippery under her feet. At least she thought it was the rain hissing in the trees. Shadows were leaping and leering at her as her light bobbed through the trees, onwards and downwards. She hurried on for another 10 or 15 minutes, soaked to the skin now and shivering, and gradually became aware that there seemed to be some other light somewhere ahead of her. It was very faint, and she wasn't certain if she was imagining it or not. She turned off her torch to see. There did seem to be some sort of dim glow ahead. She couldn't tell what it was. She turned her torch back on and continued down the hill towards whatever it was. There was something wrong with the woods, though. She couldn't immediately say what it was, but they didn't seem like sprightly, healthy woods looking forward to a good spring. The trees were lolling at sickly angles and had a sort of pallid, blighted look about them. Random more than once had the worrying sensation that they were trying to reach towards her as she passed them, but it was just a trick of the way that her light caused the shadows to flicker and lurch. Suddenly, something fell out of a tree in front of her. She leapt backwards with alarm, dropping both the torch and the box as she did so. She went down into a crouch, pulling the specially sharpened rock out of her pocket. The thing that had fallen out of the tree was moving. The torch was lying on the ground and pointing towards it, and a vast, grotesque shadow was slowly lurching through the light towards her. She could hear faint rustling and screeching noises over the steady hiss of the rain. She scrabbled on the ground for the torch, found it, and shone it directly at the creature. At the same moment, another dropped from a tree just a few feet away. She swung the torch wildly from one to another. She held her rock up, ready to throw. They were quite small, in fact. It was the angle of the light that had made them loom so large. Not only small, but small, furry, and cuddly. And there was another dropping from the trees. It fell through the beam of light, so that she saw it quite clearly. It fell neatly and precisely, turned, and then, like the other two, started slowly and purposefully to advance on Random. She stayed rooted to the spot. She still had her rock poised and ready to throw, but was increasingly conscious of the fact that the things she had it poised and ready to throw at were squirrels. Oh, or at least squirrel-like things. Soft, warm, cuddly, squirrel-like things, advancing on her in a way she wasn't at all certain she liked. She shone her torch directly on the first of them. It was making aggressive, hectoring, screeching noises, and carrying in one of its little fists a small, tattered piece of wet pink rag. Random hefted her rock menacingly in her hand, but it made no impression at all on the squirrel advancing on her with its wet piece of rag. She backed away. She didn't at all know how to deal with this. If they had been vicious, snarling, slavering beasts with glistening fangs, she would have pitched into them with a will, but squirrels behaving like this she couldn't quite handle. She backed away again. The second squirrel was starting to make a flanking manoeuvre round to her right, carrying a cup, some kind of acorn thing. The third was right behind it and making its own advance. What was it carrying? Some little scrap of soggy paper, Random thought. She stepped back again, caught her ankle against the root of a tree, and fell over backwards. Instantly, the first squirrel darted forward and was on top of her, advancing along her stomach with cold purpose in its eyes and a piece of wet rag in its fist. Random tried to jump up, but only managed to jump about an inch. The startled movement of the squirrel on her stomach startled her in return. The squirrel froze, gripping her skin through her soaking shirt with its tiny claws. Then, slowly, inch by inch, it made its way up her, stopped, and proffered her the rag. She felt almost hypnotized by the strangeness of the thing and its tiny, glinting eyes. It proffered her the rag again. It pushed it at her repeatedly, screeching insistently, till at last, nervously, hesitantly, she took the thing from it. It continued to watch her intently, its eyes darting all over her face. She had no idea what to do. Rain and mud were streaming down her face, and she had a squirrel sitting on her. She wiped some mud out of her eyes with the rag. The squirrel shrieked triumphantly, grabbed the rag back, leapt off her, ran scampering into the dark and closing night, darted up into a tree, dived into a hole in the trunk, settled back, and lit a cigarette. Meanwhile, Random was trying to fend off the squirrel with the acorn cup full of rain, and the one with the paper. She shuffled backwards on her bottom. "No," she shouted, "go away!" They darted back, in fright, and then darted right forward again with their gifts. She brandished her rock at them. "Go!" she yelled. The squirrels scampered round in consternation. Then one darted straight at her, dropped the acorn cup in her lap, turned and ran off into the night. The other stood quivering for a moment, then put its scrap of paper neatly down in front of her, and disappeared as well. She was alone again, but trembling with confusion. She got unsteadily to her feet, picked up her rock and her parcel, then paused and picked up the scrap of paper as well. It was so soggy and dilapidated, it was hard to make out what it was. It seemed just to be a fragment of an in-flight magazine. Just as Random was trying to understand exactly what it was that all this meant, a man walked out into the clearing in which she was standing, raised a vicious-looking gun, and shot her. Arthur was thrashing around hopelessly 2 or 3 miles behind her, on the upward side of the hill. Within minutes of setting out, he had gone back again and equipped himself with a lamp, not an electric one. The only electric light in the place was the one that Random had brought with her. This was a kind of dim hurricane lamp, a perforated metal canister from Strinder's forge, which contained a reservoir of inflammable fish oil, a wick of knotted dried grass, and was wrapped in a translucent film made from the dried membranes from the gut of a perfectly normal beast. It had now gone out. Arthur jiggled around with it in a thoroughly pointless kind of a way for a few seconds. There was clearly no way he was going to get the thing suddenly to burst into flame again in the middle of a rainstorm, but it's impossible not to make a token effort. Reluctantly, he threw the thing aside. What to do? This was hopeless. He was absolutely sodden, his clothes heavy and billowing with the rain, and now he was lost in the dark as well. For a brief second, he was lost in the blinding light. Then he was lost in the dark again. The sheet of lightning had at least shown him that he was very close to the brow of the hill. Once he'd breasted that, he would... Well, he wasn't certain what he'd do. He'd have to work that out when he got there. He limped forward and upwards. A few minutes later, he knew that he was standing panting at the top. There was some kind of dim glow in the distance below him. He had no idea what it was, and indeed he hardly liked to think. It was the only thing he had to make towards, though, so he started to make his way, stumbling, lost and frightened, towards it. The flash of lethal light passed straight through Random, and about 2 seconds later, so did the man who had shot it. Other than that, he paid her no attention whatsoever. He had shot someone standing behind her, and when she turned to look, he was kneeling over the body and going through its pockets. The tableau froze and vanished. It was replaced a second later by a giant pair of teeth, framed by immense and perfectly glossed red lips. A huge blue brush appeared out of nowhere and started foamily to scrub at the teeth, which continued to hang there, gleaming in the shimmering curtain of rain. Random blinked at it twice before she got it. It was a commercial. The guy who'd shot her was part of a holographic in-flight movie. She must now be very close to where the ship had crashed. Obviously some of its systems were more indestructible than others. The next half mile of the journey was particularly troublesome. Not only did she have the cold and the rain and the night to contend with, but also the fractured and thrashing remains of the ship's onboard entertainment system. Spaceships and jet cars and helipods crashed and exploded continuously around her, illuminating the night. Villainous people in strange hats smuggled dangerous drugs through her, and the combined orchestra and chorus of the Halopolis State Opera performed the closing March of the Androquantine Star Guard from Act 4 of Risgar's Blamwellimum of Wundt in a little glade somewhere off to her left. Then she was standing on the lip of a very nasty-looking and bubbly-edged crater. There was still a faint warm glow coming from what would otherwise have looked like an enormous piece of caramelized chewing gum in the center of the pit. The melted remains of a great spaceship. She stood looking at it for a longish while, and then at last started to walk along and round the edge of the crater. She was no longer certain what she was looking for, but kept moving anyway, keeping the horror of the pit to her left. The rain was beginning to ease off a little, but it was still extremely wet, and since she didn't know what it was that was in the box, whether it was perhaps something delicate or damageable, she thought she ought to find somewhere reasonably dry to open it. She hoped she hadn't already damaged it by dropping it. She played her torch around the surrounding trees, which were thin on the ground here and mostly charred and broken. In the middle distance, she thought she could see a jumbled outcrop of rock, which might provide some shelter, and she started to pick her way towards it. All around she found the detritus that had been ejected from the ship as it broke up before the final fireball. After she had moved 200 or 300 yards from the edge of the crater, she came across the tattered fragments of some fluffy pink material, sodden, mudded, and drooping amongst the broken trees. She guessed correctly that this must be the remains of the escape cocoon which had saved her father's life. She went and looked at it more closely, and then noticed something else close to it on the ground, half covered in mud. She picked it up and wiped the mud off it. It was some kind of electronic device the size of a small book. Feebly glowing on its cover, in response to her touch, were some large friendly letters. They said, "Don't panic." She knew what this was. It was her father's copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. She felt instantly reassured by it, turned her head up to the thundery sky, and let some rain wash over her face and into her mouth. She shook her head and hurried on towards the rocks. Clambering up and over them, she almost immediately found the perfect thing. The mouth of a cave. She played her torch into its interior. It seemed to be dry and safe. Picking her way carefully, she walked in. It was quite spacious, but didn't go that deep. Exhausted and relieved, she sat on a convenient rock, put the box down in front of her, and started immediately to open it.
Chapter 17.
For a long period of time, there was much speculation and controversy about where the so-called missing matter of the universe had got to. All over the galaxy, the science departments of all the major universities were acquiring more and more elaborate equipment to probe and search the hearts of distant galaxies, and then the very center and the very edges of the whole universe. But when eventually it was tracked down, it turned out, in fact, to be all the stuff which the equipment had been packed in. There was quite a large quantity of missing matter in the box, little soft round pellets of missing matter, which Random discarded for future generations of physicists to track down and discover all over again, once the findings of the current generation of physicists had been lost and forgotten about. Out of the pellets of missing matter, she lifted the featureless black disk. She put it down on a rock beside her and sifted amongst all the missing matter to see if there was anything else, a manual or some attachments or something. But there was nothing else at all, just the black disk. She shone the torch on it. As she did so, cracks began to appear along its apparently featureless surface. Random backed away nervously, but then saw that the thing, whatever it was merely unfolding itself. The process was wonderfully beautiful. It was extraordinarily elaborate, but also simple and elegant. It was like a piece of self-opening origami, or a rosebud blooming into a rose in just a few seconds. Where, just a few moments earlier, there had been a smoothly curved black disk, there was now a bird hovering there. Random continued to back away from it carefully and watchfully. It was a little like a picker-bird, only rather smaller. That is to say, in fact, it was larger, or to be more exact, precisely the same size, or at least not less than twice the size. It was also both a lot bluer and a lot pinker than picker-birds, while at the same time being perfectly black. There was also something very odd about it, which Random couldn't immediately make out. It certainly shared with picker-birds the impression it gave that it was watching something that you couldn't see. Suddenly it vanished. Then, just as suddenly, everything went black. Random dropped into a tense crouch, feeling for the specially sharpened rock in her pocket again. Then the blackness receded and rolled itself up into a ball, and then the blackness was the bird again. It hung in the air in front of her, beating its wings slowly and staring at her. "Excuse me," it said suddenly, "I just have to calibrate myself. Can you hear me when I say this?"
"When you say what?" demanded Random.
"Good," said the bird.
"And can you hear me when I say this?"
It spoke this time at a much higher pitch.
"Yes, of course I can," said Random.
"And can you hear me when I say this?" it said, this time in a sepulchrally deep voice.
"Yes!"
Then there was a pause.
"No, obviously not," said the bird after a few seconds. "Good, well, your hearing range is obviously between 16 and 20 kilohertz." "So, is this comfortable for you?" it said in a pleasant light tenor. "No uncomfortable harmonics screeching away in the upper register?" "Obviously not. Good, I can use those as data channels. Now, how many of me can you see?"
Suddenly the air was full of nothing but interlocking birds. Random was well used to spending time in virtual realities, but this was something far weirder than anything she had previously encountered. It was as if the whole geometry of space was redefined in seamless bird shapes. Random gasped and flung her arms around her face, her arms moving through bird-shaped space.
"Obviously way too many," said the bird. "How about now?"
It concertinaed into a tunnel of birds, as if it was a bird caught between parallel mirrors, reflecting infinitely into the distance.
"What are you?" shouted Random.
"We'll come to that in a minute," said the bird. "Just how many, please?"
"Well, you're sort of..."
Random gestured helplessly off into the distance. "I see, still infinite in extent, but at least we're homing in on the right dimensional matrix. Good. No, the answer is an orange and two lemons."
"Lemons?"
said Random.
"If I have three lemons and three oranges, and I lose two oranges and a lemon, what do I have left?"
"Huh? OK, so you think that time flows that way, do you? Interesting. Am I still infinite?" it asked, ballooning this way and that in space. "Am I infinite now? How yellow am I?" Moment by moment, the bird was going through mind-mangling transformations of shape and extent.
"I can't," said Random, bewildered.
"You don't have to answer. I can tell from watching you now. So, am I your mother? Am I a rock? Do I seem huge, squishy, and sinuously intertwined? No? How about now? Am I going backwards?" For once, the bird was perfectly still and steady.
No, said Random. Well, I was, in fact, but I was moving backwards in time. Well, I think we've sorted all that out now. If you'd like to know, I can tell you that in your universe, you move freely in three dimensions that you call space. You move in a straight line in a fourth, which you call time, and stay rooted to one place in a fifth, which is the first fundamental of probability. After that, it gets a bit complicated, and there's all sorts of stuff going on in dimensions 13 to 22 that you really wouldn't want to know about. All you really need to know for the moment is that the universe is a lot more complicated than you might think, even if you start from a position of thinking it's pretty damn complicated in the first place. I can easily not say words like damn if it offends you. Say what you damn well like, said Random. I will. What the hell are you? Demanded Random. I am the guide. In your universe, I am your guide. In fact, I inhabit what is technically known as the whole sort of general mishmash, which means, well, let me show you. It turned in midair and swooped out of the cave, and then perched on a rock, just beneath an overhang, out of the rain, which was getting heavier again. Come on, it said. Watch this. Random didn't like being bossed around by a bird, but she followed it to the mouth of the cave anyway, still fingering the rock in her pocket. Rain, said the bird. You see? Just rain. I know what rain is, said Random. Sheets of the stuff were sweeping through the night, moonlight sifting through it. So what is it? What do you mean, what is it? Look, who are you? What were you doing in that box? Why have I spent a night running through the forest, fending off demented squirrels, to find that all I've got at the end is a bird asking me what rain is? It's just water falling through the bloody air, that's what it is. Anything else you want to know, or can we go home now? There was a long pause before the bird answered, You want to go home? I haven't got a home! Random almost shocked herself. She screamed the word so loudly. Look into the rain, said the bird guide. I'm looking into the rain. What else is there to look at? What do you see? What do you mean, you stupid bird? I just see a lot of rain. It's just water falling. What shapes do you see in the water? Shapes? There aren't any shapes. It's just a mishmash, said the bird guide. Yes. Now what do you see? Just on the very edge of visibility, a thin, faint beam fanned out of the bird's eyes. In the dry air beneath the overhang, there was nothing to see. Where the beam hit the drops of water as they fell through it, there was a flat sheet of light, so bright and vivid it seemed solid. Oh, great, a laser show, said Random fractiously. Never seen one of those before, of course, except at about 5 million rock concerts. Tell me what you see. Just a flat sheet, stupid bird. There's nothing there that wasn't there before. I'm just using light to draw your attention to certain drops at certain moments. Now what do you see? The light shut off. Nothing. I'm doing exactly the same thing, but with ultraviolet light, you can't see it. So what's the point of showing me something I can't see? So that you understand that just because you see something doesn't mean to say it's there, and if you don't see something, it doesn't mean to say it's not there. It's only what your senses bring to your attention. I'm bored of this, said Random, and then gasped. Hanging in the rain was a giant and very vivid three-dimensional image of her father, looking startled about something. About 2 miles behind Random, her father, struggling his way through the woods, suddenly stopped. He was startled to see an image of himself looking startled about something, hanging brightly in the rain-filled air about 2 miles away. About 2 miles away, some distance to the right of the direction in which he was heading. He was almost completely lost, was convinced he was going to die of cold and wet and exhaustion, and was beginning to wish he could just get on with it. He had just been brought an entire golfing magazine by a squirrel as well, and his brain was beginning to howl and gibber. Seeing a huge bright image of himself light up in the sky told him that, on balance, he was probably right to howl and gibber, but probably wrong as far as the direction he was heading was concerned. Taking a deep breath, he turned and headed off towards the inexplicable light show. "Okay, so what's that supposed to prove?" demanded Random. It was the fact that the image was her father that had startled her, rather than the appearance of the image itself. She had seen her first hologram when she was 2 months old, and had been put in it to play. She had seen her most recent one about half an hour ago, playing the march of the Androquantine Starguard. "Only that it's no more there or not there than the sheet was," said the bird. It's just the interaction of water from the sky moving in one direction with light at frequencies your senses can detect moving in another. It makes an apparently solid image in your mind, but it's all just images in the mishmash. Here's another one for you. My mother,
said Random. No, said the bird. I know my mother when I see her.
The image was of a woman emerging from a spacecraft inside a large grey hangar-like building. She was being escorted by a group of tall, thin, purplish-green creatures. It was definitely Random's mother. Well, almost definitely. Trillian wouldn't have been walking quite so uncertainly in low gravity, or looking around her at a boring old life-support environment with quite such a disbelieving look on her face, or carrying such a quaint old camera.
"So who is it?" demanded Random.
"She is part of the extent of your mother on the probability axis," said the bird guide.
"I haven't the faintest idea what you mean," said Random.
"Space, time, and probability all have axes along which it is possible to move."
"Still don't know, though I think..." No,
explain."
"I thought you wanted to go home," said the bird.
"Explain!"
"Would you like to see your home?"
"See it? It was destroyed!"
"It is discontinuous along the probability axis. Look." Something very strange and wonderful now swam into view in the rain. It was a huge, bluish-greenish globe, misty and cloud-covered, turning with majestic slowness against a black, starry background.
"Now you see it," said the bird.
"Now you don't."
A little less than 2 miles away now, Arthur Dent stood still in his tracks. He could not believe what he could see, hanging there, shrouded in rain, but brilliant and vividly real against the night sky. The Earth. He gasped at the sight of it. Then, at the moment he gasped, it disappeared again. Then it appeared again. Then, and this is the bit that made him give up and stick straws in his hair, it turned into a sausage. Random was also bewildered at the sight of this huge, blue and green and watery and misty sausage hanging above her. And now it was a string of sausages, or rather it was a string of sausages in which many of the sausages were missing. The whole brilliant string turned and span in a bewildering dance in the air, and then gradually slowed, grew insubstantial, and faded into the glistening darkness of the night.
"What was that?" asked Random in a small voice.
"A glimpse along the probability axis of a discontinuously probable object."
"I see," said Random.
"Most objects mutate and change along their axis of probability, but the world of your origin does something slightly different. It lies on what you might call a fault line in the landscape of probability, which means that at many probability coordinates, the whole of it simply ceases to exist. It has an inherent instability, which is typical of anything that lies within what are usually designated the plural sectors. Make sense?"
"No."
"Want to go and see for yourself?"
"To Earth?"
"Yes," said the bird.
"Is that possible?"
The bird guide did not answer at once. It spread its wings and, with an easy grace, ascended into the air and flew out into the rain, which once again was beginning to lighten. It soared ecstatically up into the night sky. Lights flashed around it. Dimensions dithered in its wake. It swooped and turned and looped and turned again, and came at last to rest 2 feet in front of Random's face, its wings beating slowly and silently. It spoke to her again. "Your universe is vast to you, vast in time, vast in space. That's because of the filters through which you perceive it. But I was built with no filters at all, which means I perceive the mishmash, which contains all possible universes, but which has itself no size at all. For me, anything is possible. I am omniscient and omnipotent, extremely vain, and what is more, I come in a handy self-carrying package. You have to work out how much of the above is true."
A slow smile spread over Random's face.
"You bloody little thing, you've been winding me up."
"As I said, anything is possible."
Random laughed. "Okay," she said. "Let's try and go to Earth. Let's go to Earth at some point on its,
probability axis?"
"Yes, where it hasn't been blown up." "Okay, so you're the guide. How do we get a lift?"
"Reverse engineering," said the bird.
"What?"
"Reverse engineering. To me, the flow of time is irrelevant. You decide what you want. I then merely make sure that it has already happened."
"You're joking."
"Anything is possible." Random frowned.
"You are joking, aren't you?"
Let me put it another way, said the bird. Reverse engineering enables us to shortcut all the business of waiting for one of the horribly few spaceships that passes through your galactic sector every year or so to make up its mind about whether or not it feels like giving you a lift. You want a lift? A ship arrives and gives you one. The pilot may think he has any one of a million reasons why he has decided to stop and pick you up. The real reason is that I have determined that he will. This is you being extremely vain, isn't it, little bird? Said Random. The bird was silent. Okay, said Random. I want a ship to take me to Earth. Will this one do? It was so silent that Random had not noticed the descending spaceship until it was nearly on top of her. Arthur had noticed it. He was a mile away now and closing. Just after the illuminated sausage display had drawn to its conclusion, he had noticed the faint glimmerings of further lights coming down out of the clouds, and had, to begin with, assumed it to be another piece of flashy Sonne Lumiere. It took a moment or so for it to dawn on him that it was an actual spaceship, and a moment or two longer for him to realize that it was dropping directly down to where he assumed his daughter to be. That was when, rain or no rain, old leg injury or no leg injury, darkness or no darkness, he suddenly started really to run. He fell almost immediately, slid and hurt his knee quite badly on a rock. He slithered back up to his feet and tried again. He had a horrible cold feeling that he was about to lose Random forever. Limping and cursing, he ran. He didn't know what it was that had been in the box, but the name on it had been Ford Prefect, and that was the name he cursed as he ran. The ship was one of the sexiest and most beautiful ones that Random had ever seen. It was astounding, sleek, silver, ineffable. If she didn't know better, she would have said it was an RW-6. As it settled silently beside her, she realized that it actually was an RW-6, and she could scarcely breathe for excitement. An RW-6 was the sort of thing you only saw in the sort of magazines that were designed to provoke civil unrest. She was also extremely nervous. The manner and timing of its arrival was deeply unsettling. Either it was the most bizarre coincidence, or something very peculiar and worrying was going on. She waited a little tensely for the ship's hatch to open. Her guide, she thought of it as hers now, was hovering lightly over her right shoulder, its wings barely fluttering. The hatch opened. Just a little dim light escaped. A moment or two passed, and a figure emerged. He stood still for a moment or so, obviously trying to accustom his eyes to the darkness. Then he caught sight of Random standing there, and seemed a little surprised. He started to walk towards her, then suddenly he shouted in surprise and started to run at her. Random was not a good person to take a run at on a dark night when she was feeling a little strung out. She had unconsciously been fingering the rock in her pocket from the moment she saw the craft coming down. Still running, slithering, hurtling, and bumping into trees, Arthur saw at last that he was too late. The ship had only been on the ground for about 3 minutes, and now, silently, gracefully, it was rising up above the trees again, turning smoothly in the fine speckle of rain to which the storm had now abated. Climbing, climbing, tipping up its nose, and suddenly, effortlessly, hurtling up through the clouds. Gone. Random was in it. It was impossible for Arthur to know this, but he just went ahead and knew it anyway. She was gone. He had had his stint at being a parent, and could scarcely believe how badly he had done at it. He tried to continue running, but his feet were dragging, his knee was hurting like fury, and he knew that he was too late. He could not conceive that he could feel more wretched and awful than this. But he was wrong. He limped his way at last to the cave where Random had sheltered and opened the box. The ground bore the indentations of the spacecraft that had landed there only minutes before, but of Random there was no sign. He wandered disconsolately into the cave, found the empty box and piles of missing matter pellets strewn around the place. He felt a little cross about that. He tried to teach her about cleaning up after herself. Feeling a bit cross with her about something like that helped him feel less desolate about her leaving. He knew he had no means of finding her. His foot knocked against something unexpected. He bent down to pick it up, and was thoroughly surprised to discover what it was. It was his old Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. How did that come to be in the cave? He had never returned to collect it from the scene of the crash. He had not wanted to revisit the crash, and he had not wanted the guide again. He had reckoned he was here, on Lamuella, making sandwiches for good. How did it come to be in the cave? It was active. The words on the cover flashed "Don't panic" at him. He went out of the cave again into the dim and damp moonlight. He sat on a rock to have a look through the old guide, and then discovered it wasn't a rock. It was a person. Chapter 18. Arthur leapt to his feet with a start of fear. It would be hard to say which he was more frightened of, that he might have hurt the person he had inadvertently sat on, or that the person he had inadvertently sat on would hurt him back. There seemed, on inspection, to be little immediate cause for alarm on the second count. Whoever it was he had sat on was unconscious. That will probably go a great deal of the way towards explaining what he was doing lying there. He seemed to be breathing okay, though. Arthur felt his pulse. That was okay as well. He was lying on his side, half curled up. It was so long ago and far away when Arthur had last done first aid that he couldn't really remember what it was he was supposed to do. The first thing he was supposed to do, he remembered, was to have a first aid kit about his person. Damn. Should he roll him on his back or not? Suppose he had any broken bones? Suppose he swallowed his tongue? Suppose he sued him? Who, apart from anything else, was he? At that moment, the unconscious man groaned loudly and rolled himself over. Arthur wondered if he should... He looked at him. He looked at him again. He looked at him again just to make absolutely sure. Despite the fact that he'd been thinking he was feeling about as low as he possibly could, he experienced a terrible sinking feeling. The figure groaned again and slowly opened his eyes. It took him a while to focus, then he blinked and stiffened. "You!" said Ford Prefect. "You!" said Arthur Dent. Ford groaned again. "What do you need to have explained this time?" he said, and closed his eyes in some kind of despair. End of side 6.